Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Checking Valley traffic, I-10 eastbound, an accident at 32nd Street, and on the 101 northbound in the West Valley, an accident at Camelback. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon, looking for a forecast high of 90 degrees. 73 is average for today. If we hit 90, it will break the record for today. Clear skies tonight, overnight lows in the upper 50s, sunny and 91 tomorrow. Cloudy skies over Phoenix right now, 84 degrees at KJZZ. A proposal to expand Arizona's Empowerment Scholarship account, basically vouchers, to allow any student to go to a private school using public money, appears to be in trouble at the state capitol. Joining me to talk about that and other things legislature is Jim Small, editor of Arizona Capital Times. Jim, the voucher bill's having problems. What's going on?
It is. And, yesterday it was scheduled to go on the floor for a vote. And for the second time in 2 weeks, the House basically skipped over the bill and said, we're not going to hear it today, which is indicative of the fact that it doesn't have the votes for it. And that was something that we heard last week. There were six or seven Republicans, from what we've heard, that were solid no's on it and potentially up to as many as about a dozen, maybe 10 or a dozen, who were leaning strongly against it. In a lot of ways, it's really not surprising. In the past couple of years, there have been attempts to, you know, certainly incrementally increase this voucher, this empowerment scholarship account program. And in the House, in the past couple of years, they've actually run into some real heavy resistance at doing some larger expansions of it, or even medium-sized expansions of it, really. And I think that those dynamics are still at play today.
School funding at the beginning of the year was seen as an interesting. People were very excited and interested to see what Governor Ducey would propose in that regard in his budget. Where do we stand on budget talks? I mean, it seems like there's some suggestion that things are dragging out a little bit more than they expected.
Yeah, budget talks are happening, certainly at the high level between the governor's office and the Republican leadership in both the House and the Senate. But so far, those talks haven't produced anything that's been really taken out to the lawmakers and presented to them in terms of, you know, kind of here's the framework for the budget we're working on. Everyone's been fairly tight-lipped about it as well. And we have heard some of those same things, though, that the talks are dragging on and going a little bit slower, certainly than they did last year. I think they got a budget done in 65 days last year. Basically, by the end of this current week would be the equivalent of when they got the budget done last year. I don't see any possibility for that happening this year. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if, you know, in 2 weeks' time, we find out that they've closed the gap, they've hammered out the differences, and they're ready to move forward on a budget and get things moving.
There's a conventional wisdom out there that it's almost in some ways more difficult to do a budget when there is a little bit of money to spend because you have to sort of pick and choose what you say yes to and what you say no to, as opposed to when there's no money, you can just say no to everybody. Do you get the sense that that's what's going on this year? That's what's maybe causing things to move a little more slowly?
It's definitely a different dynamic. I think that's probably part of it. But I think, you know, a bigger part of it is just that the governor's office and the legislature, you know, when they both kind of put out their baseline starting budget proposals, they come from very different places, and they make some very different assumptions about the state of Arizona's economy and what it's going to mean for revenues and what it's going to mean for expenditures.
How do you see the rest of this session playing out now that both the leaders in the legislature have their eyes on Congress?
It definitely changes the dynamics a little bit. I think everyone had always kind of viewed David Gowen. I think the session probably needs to end sooner rather than later for him. He's from Sierra Vista, and he's campaigning in a district that's largely in eastern and northern Arizona and down in Pinal County. It's a very large district, and it takes a lot of time in order to make it from event to event to event in that place, or fundraiser to fundraiser. So it probably behooves him to get out of the Capitol as quickly as possible. On the flip side, you know, Andy Biggs, who I think in most situations you would be viewed as someone who wants to get out of the Capitol as quickly as possible as well. But with his congressional announcement last week, I think you could make a case that it might actually be better for him to stay at the Capitol for a little while. It allows him to wield the power of the presidency while he's a candidate, something that he hasn't been able to do up to this point. And he's not hampered by being at the Capitol nearly as much as someone like David Gowan is, because Andy Biggs is from Gilbert. His congressional district is basically the East Valley. You know, at most, you're talking 30 or 45 minutes away from the Capitol. He's not going to be put out in the same kind of way that someone like David Gowan is, who has to drive 2 or 3 hours to get somewhere.
Jim Small is editor of the Arizona Capital Times. Jim, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Arizona District Public Schools spent on average a little more than half of their money in the classroom last year, the lowest percentage since the state began monitoring this metric 15 years ago. That's according to a report from state auditors released today. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan reports, as the state has cut education funding over the past several years, lawmakers have been more closely scrutinizing where those dollars are spent.
The flashcards these second graders are sounding out and their teachers' pay are both considered classroom spending. The desks and lights, however, aren't. Well, according to state auditors. While these differences don't matter to these 6 or 7-year-olds, they do matter to Ken Hicks. He relies on account codes for everything.
It's our lifeblood, so how we can identify and track things.
Hicks is the finance guy at Peoria Unified School District. He gathers and presents spending data according to categories, like instruction, administration, and operational costs. He says education funding cuts over the past several years have created a drought situation.
As the water hole continues to shrink, everybody starts looking around and questioning, what are you doing? Don't be drinking my water.
Which is why he believes there has been increased scrutiny of school spending. But Hicks warns the way schools account for their expenditures is subject to federal guidelines. For example, this year, he says the public will see a slice of classroom spending in Peoria decrease, while spending in other areas increase.
It did not mean that we hired a single new administrator or that we gave them huge raises.
He explains the increase in administration is a required coding change for retiree benefits. Hicks points out this report is limited to district schools. Charters aren't included. The Auditor General's office cites state law as the reason.
You have a growing percent of our population of students that are going to a system that is not having the same oversight or the same transparency or the same accountability that the others are.
State auditors do separately compile charter school audits, but the office says it isn't required to publish that report. 15% of Arizona public school students go to charters, and the state regulatory agency has the ability to potentially sanction schools not meeting standards. Arizona Charter School Association President Eileen Sigmund says while she keeps an eye on classroom spending, parents are most concerned about the quality of education and not the exact dollar breakdown.
If a charter's not doing their job, then parents will stop sending their kids, and that is the ultimate form of accountability.
The Arizona Department of Education analyzes how charters compare to district schools in terms of spending. Districts spend more in the classroom per student than charters, but charters spend close to double that of district schools on administration per student. Sigmund explains that number can be a bit misleading, again, thanks to coding.
Our personnel wear different hats, and so the reason the numbers may look like charters don't spend as much as in the classroom may simply be because an administrator may not capture herself as a teacher.
But both Sigmund and CFO of the Peoria District, Hicks, say the measure they care most about is student achievement. Bruce Baker is a Rutgers University researcher specializing in school finance.
The studies that have tried to look at, you know, is there a magic number for the percent that should go to the classroom or to schools that have a higher percent going to the classroom as opposed to administration? And those studies haven't really come to a clear and obvious conclusion that greater administrative expense is bad.
Baker says his research suggests the spending that most directly impacts student achievement is teacher salaries and class sizes. Arizona is among the states with the least competitive teacher pay when compared to peers with similar education. The state also has larger class sizes than the national average. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Permits for new home construction in the Valley were at their highest level in December since 2008. That's according to a new report from ASU's Mike Orr, who also found Peoria led the way in new home closings, followed by 2 East Valley cities. Orr is the director of the Center for Real Estate Theory and Practice, and he joins me. So, Mike, based on your research, is it fair to say things are reasonably okay in the Valley's housing market?
Yeah, I would think that's fair. We're pretty much back to normal overall. But when you home in on different price ranges, there are quite significant imbalances between supply and demand. But you know, compared with the last 10 years, we're in a pretty healthy state.
And it looks like the rental market, of all things, is impacting that supply and demand factor.
Yes. We've got a lot of people renting rather than owning homes, some higher percentage than 10 years ago. And even though a lot of foreclosed homes went to landlords to be turned into rentals, we're still short of rental homes. And that's causing landlords to hang on to those homes, not put them back into the market. And that means there is very little supply at the low end for people to buy. We've kind of got the opposite problem at the top, where there's actually quite good supply of homes once you get up into the higher reaches. In the mid-range, the market's quite balanced, but at the top end, we've probably got a little too much, given that demand is relatively moderate for the luxury homes at the moment.
You found a lot of growth in Peoria, Gilbert, and Mesa, and I'm wondering what it is about those cities that led to that.
Probably the primary factor is available land that either the builders already own or prices they can afford to build. In North Peoria, there's plenty of open space. East Mesa and large chunks of Gilbert have got plenty of land to build on that's not prohibitively expensive. So that's where they choose to construct homes in larger numbers.
So is that an indication then of where developers would have built had the recession and the housing crash not happened quite to the extent it had here?
They'd have probably built, if we hadn't had the recession, they'd have built those probably eight years ago and be now on to new areas, because we're still constructing homes at relatively modest volumes compared with 2004, 5, and 6.
Are there particular parts of town that you are looking at as maybe the next Peoria, Mesa, Gilbert?
Well, I would say that the popular places to build new homes aren't necessarily the most popular places for resales. It's kind of two different markets. So there's very little new construction going on in the sort of urban centers, but a lot of people are wanting to live there. We are starting to see some high-rise projects for purchase. We've seen quite a lot of high-rise purchase for rent, but we're now starting to see a few of them for purchase, and there's a lot of demand. It's very popular these days for all sorts of age groups to move back into where the shopping and the restaurants and the entertainment districts are. So you're not going to see the traditional single-family homes built there because the land is too expensive, but tightly packed, dense housing, probably multi-floor condos or apartment-style condos are going to be the norm for some of these areas, particularly central Scottsdale. Probably the area between Scottsdale and Tempe will become more and more attractive from that point of view, and in downtown and uptown Phoenix too.
Mike Orr is the director of the Center for Real Estate Theory and Practice at ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business.
It's the show on KJZZ for Tuesday, March 1st. Along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry today, I'm Mark Brody. Amazon, the retailer, seems to have outgrown its relationship with the Postal Service, FedEx, and UPS. Impatient over service lapses, Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, who has his own rocket company, may be interested in amassing his own fleet of planes, trains, trucks, and drones to deliver goods. That would make Amazon a full-blown global logistics company.
Internal Amazon documents reveal a plan for a global delivery network that would control the flow of goods from China to the U.S. John Wells is a professor of management practice at Harvard Business School and a former CFO for PepsiCo and Frito-Lay. He says for an online retailer, efficient logistics is critical, and the U.S. is actually way behind its competitors.
Customers want speed, and they want it for nothing. And so Amazon is spending a lot of time looking around the world at how it can actually improve its performance. Many say that they're looking into competing in China. I doubt that they will do particularly well there because there's some very sophisticated competitors in China. JD.com is the lead player in Amazon's space. It is the Amazon of China. They deliver 85% of their product either the same day or the following day, way ahead of what happens in the United States. But Alibaba is the granddad, the absolute granddad of online in China. They're a marketplace. Amazon is also a marketplace, but they've got five times the size of Amazon and also delivering a lot the same day, the following day, and they're going down to doing it within 2 hours. In the United States, expensive, slow logistics is holding back the development of online retail.
So China makes this an absolute imperative for Amazon. It's not simply being annoyed at the U.S. Postal Service or UPS or FedEx.
What's actually happening in this space, to be competitive, you have to offer very fast delivery and typically free. It's amazing what happens when you take the delivery charges away and sales boom. But in order to do that, in order to offer very low-cost delivery, you need to keep your inventory near the customer. And so what's happening is people are distributing their product ever closer to the customer. Alibaba is just buying, at the moment, the number one consumer electronics retail bricks and mortar store, and in order that they can put product there and deliver it within 2 hours to the consumer. That's the equivalent, by the way, of Amazon buying Best Buy in order to get closer to the consumer. Now, the only problem is, how do you get it from the local stores to the consumer's front door, the last mile? And this is the big challenge. Ideally, you get them to pick it up. And up to half of customers like to come and pick it up. But the other half, how do you get it to them and how do you get it to them quickly? Well, Amazon is figuring out a very cost-effective way. They're creating the equivalent of Uber. They're testing it. It's Uber, Amazon Now, Amazon Next. They're actually getting drivers with their own cars to deliver the parcels very, very cost-effectively. Question, you know, can UPS do this? And the United States Parcel Service do this? Two-hour delivery using non-union labor? I very much doubt it. But Amazon must forge the way if it really wants to offer and be competitive and really drive more online retailing in the United States.
Are UPS warehouses and FedEx warehouses, are they duplicates, essentially, of what Amazon already has?
No, not really, basically. But from Amazon's point of view, what they need to do is to put these locations, these distribution locations, with the exact inventory they require close to the consumers. We all already have an infrastructure like that in the United States. It's called big box stores. You know, you take a Best Buy, they're probably within 20 minutes of 80 or 90% of the U.S. population. The only issue is at the moment they consider themselves to be bricks and mortar retailers as opposed to distribution centers and showrooms and places for people to come and return their products.
So when are we going to see this? In other words, how soon will Amazon make its footprint known on streets and in, you know, sort of delivery fleets?
It's happening now, essentially. I think their test that Amazon Now is in more than 20 cities in the world. Amazon Next is being tested in four or five in the United States at the moment. If these prove cost effective, we'll see them roll out very, very aggressively. Specialized warehouses and the capability of integrating all of this into one much more effective logistics operation. That is Amazon's business. They've been in it right from the very start. They've been in it 20 years and they're getting better and better at it.
Can you be profitable in the last mile distribution game if you don't deliver other people's stuff, particularly if one of the features of your product is that you give your delivery service for free?
You have to remember there are some consumers that once they've decided to buy something, I'd call them the now generation, they want it now. Others are prepared to wait a couple of days, and they can probably get a more cost-effective service through the United States Postal Service. Now, there's literally hundreds of thousands of people that are prepared to sign up for this. I could almost imagine, being controversial, that the employees of the United States Parcel Service during their day shift will be delivering parcels on a regular basis, and then they'll be doing a second shift on their own account because they know where the addresses are and can do it faster than other players. The issue is if you provide a lot of the volume to any player out there, then you effectively control them and you can get excellent service.
John Wells, professor of management practice at Harvard Business School and chair of the Senior Retail Forum at Harvard. Thank you so much, Professor.
You're most welcome.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. Astronaut Scott Kelly is scheduled to return to Earth tonight after 340 days in space. He and his identical twin brother, retired astronaut Mark Kelly, are taking part in a study to determine the effects of long-duration space travel on the human body. From the Arizona Science Desk in Tucson, Sarah Hammond reports.
Mark Kelly spent a total of 54 days in space as an astronaut. When NASA asked if he would be part of a twin study during his brother's near year in space, he didn't hesitate.
I agreed to it because NASA asked. So they asked, and I said yes. I mean, I'm a big fan of science and research, and I'm incredibly grateful to NASA and the U.S. government. to give me the opportunity to have an incredible career there for 15 years, so it didn't take much.
What Kelly signed up for was being a research subject, along with his brother, to be scrutinized by scientists from a dozen universities from the U.S. and abroad. They're looking for physiological and psychological changes that nearly a year in space might have caused.
In general, there's like 10 major experiments. A lot of them are molecular and genetic with regards to Scott and I and our genomes and our genes and our mitochondria and molecular things like, as an example, one of them looks at the length of our telomeres. And telomeres are, you know, I think it's part of our DNA. I'm not even sure. I don't have to be the scientist here. I just have to give the samples. And it's looking at the effect of being in space on the age of the human body. You know, there's your age according to the calendar, but then there's your physical age. And those are not always the same. And the length of your telomeres is indicative of your physical age.
Telomeres are the caps at the end of each strand of DNA that protect chromosomes, like the plastic tips at the end of shoelaces. Because the Kellys are identical twins, their DNA, including genes, mitochondria, and telomeres, are mostly identical. Or they were nearly identical before Scott's time in space. The research will tell if that's still true. Scott Kelly spoke about the research in a press conference from the International Space Station last week.
One part of it is kind of a new area that NASA is getting into with this study is the effects of spaceflight on a genetic level. And so that's something I'm pretty excited about, you know, for personal reasons, but also for the research to try to have a better understanding how this microgravity environment and the radiation environment affects us genetically. You know, there's a lot to learn, and as we've seen over the last 10 years, you know, that discipline of science has really just taken off, so it's great to see us starting to focus on that in space as well.
Mark Kelly says he's interested in learning about vision problems that long-mission spacemen have experienced, and men is the operative word here.
Other experiments have to do with astronauts' vision. It's interesting. I think it's about 30% of male astronauts that spend a long time in space have a serious degradation in their vision due to a change in their optic nerve. For women, not the same amount. It's 0%. It hasn't happened to a single woman yet. So maybe when we send astronauts to Mars for the first time, it'll be a crew of women. Who knows?
Mark Kelly says these 12 months are not the longest time he has been away from his younger brother, younger by 6 minutes.
This is not the longest I've gone without seeing him, and he's been in space for nearly a year. I was stationed in Japan for 2.5 years. I think at that point, you know, we probably went a stretch of about maybe a year and a half.
The current separation has been softened by regular communication.
People are like, well, what is it like for him to be off the planet for a year? I mean, this must be really hard on you. No, it's not hard on me. I mean, I talk to him on the phone about every day.
Mark Kelly says he and a number of family members are in Houston today as the Soyuz spacecraft will return Scott and his Russian crewmates to Kazakhstan. They'll be reunited tomorrow in Texas.
He'll land in Kazakhstan. He'll go take a shower. He'll do some medical tests. He'll get something to eat. And then he'll be on a NASA airplane coming home.
Mark Kelly says he misses space travel and would have liked to have had a long flight, just not one lasting for a year. I'm Sarah Hammond in Tucson.
There is an effort underway on the Navajo Nation to develop a general management plan for its tribal parks, which would basically bring the nation's four parks under one umbrella. Joining me with more on this are Helen Webster, she's the park manager at Little Colorado River Tribal Park, and Tony Skrilanis, Native America Program Director for Grand Canyon Trust. They're also both board members of the corporation owned by seven Navajo communities that's working on the plan.
These parks, they're tribal parks, meaning, and they're not in any way similar to national parks or state parks. These are living parks, and they're also cross-jurisdiction. They're within the chapters also. So the chapters have their own governance and ordinance authority over the lands, along with the Navajo Nation also created these. The parks have never had a full general management plan. They've never had a full control of these lands.
Tony, when you say it's a living park, what do you mean?
Well, it's alive. People are living there.
What are you trying to accomplish with a general management plan? Why take that approach?
Well, along with myself and other park managers, we felt like that we really need this comprehensive general management plan, which is going to be like a roadmap for us in the future. And we feel that the general management plan is going to cover a lot of areas where there's going to be research done on geology and significant areas within the parks and maybe even the flight zone and a lot of other things where we want to identify lands that will be potential for economic development purposes in the future. We want to make sure that we want to identify and put it down on paper in the general management plan.
And then, Mark, if I could add on, you know, after 40 years of the what's called the Bennett Freeze, which was a federally mandated freeze to attempt to settle a land dispute between the Hopi and the Navajo, it really put a freeze on any development, any water lines, any infrastructure, any improvements, any business development. And so that was lifted just a few years ago by President Obama. And that really opened the door. But the resources in this area, in Marble Canyon and Little Colorado, there's some of the most incredible resources. The views on the Navajo side of the Grand Canyon, you can feel the river. You can experience the Grand Canyon. You can hear it. You can see it. You can see the rafts going through. And so more and more, this area is getting a lot of pressure, too. There's a proposal to by outside developers to do a massive park, like a theme park that has an escalade to the bottom of the canyon. And all the families in that area, they're very traditional. They all oppose it. And so what this opens the door is there's a need for protection of resources. There's a real need mm-hmm. to plan it carefully to figure out what is the proper carrying capacity of this area.
How do you balance the need for economic growth and economic sort of a stimulus there, but also protect the land and respect the needs and the wishes of the folks who have lived there, in many cases, for many, many generations?
You do it through a careful process. And what we're attempting to do, and we've already laid this out on how we're going to go about it, is we have a process of educating the community about economics and also at the same time capturing the cultural stories, capturing the places that have real importance, significance, the places that should be off limits, the places that should be considered sacred areas, and then also looking at the plant overlay, the land carrying capacity overlay, and then creating instruments to monitor the changes, everything on the land, and also the impacts on the families. But then the community being comfortable with development, being comfortable and saying, here's the things that we will allow.
Have you found that local chapters are amenable to essentially giving up some of their local control in the interest of having sort of this broad umbrella group that is managing and overseeing all of the parks?
I think right now they feel like they have lost control, and we want them to have control again. Yeah. And I think that's the basic and idea in this general management plan that we know, and we're beginning to see that now.
How much do you look to the U.S. National Park Service in terms of trying to figure out like how you manage them, not necessarily where the parks are and all that, but how you actually manage all of these different parks in different places?
Well, it's one of the eighth wonders of the world. The Navajo, there's a large portion of the Grand Canyon that lies within the Navajo Nation. And the Little Colorado River lies entirely within the Navajo Nation. These, in essence, are world-class resources. And they just are untapped. They've never have had opportunities for visitors to really experience it. But we look to the national park because they're the example. They're the example of bringing in visitors and protecting resources and really having a plan for how that protection takes place, what the community opportunities are, what the cultural protections and sacred site protections are. So that's really a model. But we want to take this further than that. We really want to, you know, again, these are living parks, so we have to create local economic opportunity. We have to create a different type of co-management and governance. I guess the way to put it is, you know, there's grandmas out there. There's folks that ride horses. There's people that are herding sheep or you know, living in their homes that are like 20 miles from the highway. And they're used to a certain pace of life and a certain quality of life that's really quiet. And so we have to respect that and figure out a system for that. And so that's what makes this process very unique, is that the driver is more protection.
Helen, is part of the goal of having this management plan the ability to draw in more visitors to these parks?
Probably to only areas which will be identified for those potential, but then we also going to have to put a cap on how many people we can service in those areas. So we really need to carefully plan that.
Helen Webster is the park manager at Little Colorado River Tribal Park. We also heard from Tony Skrilanis, Native America Program Director for Grand Canyon Trust. They're also both board members of the corporation owned by seven Navajo communities that's working on a general management plan for the four Navajo tribal parks. They expect to roll that plan out park by park. Phoenix has more than 800 miles of arterial and major collector streets, not to mention more residential roads. That's a lot of pavement, and the city has one really tricked-out van that drives those streets assessing their condition. I met up with Todd Nunn, a chief engineering technician with the city, who showed me around the van.
We have two right-of-way cameras, one in the front, one in the back. Also two high-definition cameras that face down that are taking pictures of the pavement, and a roughness laser in the front. As we're driving along, it's going to be taking these high-definition pictures. We take those back to the office and run it through a software called Vision that looks for the crack and determines what type of maintenance needs to be done.
Nunn didn't mention the seven computers on board. He says the van collects a ton of data, which helps city engineers figure out which streets are doing okay, which need some work, and for those, what kind of work they may need. I asked Nunn exactly how that happens.
Just by taking the pictures as we're driving along, and then the software that I mentioned earlier, Vision, it goes through and looks at all the cameras, and it can detect the cracks in the pavement.
Do you ever use just your visual observations when you're driving around?
After the analysis done in the office, we have other people that go out and just double check some of the worst ones.
What kinds of things will the data tell you when you analyze the photos and the coordinates and everything? What kinds of information does that give you? And what does that tell you as far as what you then need to do to try to make things better?
It tells us the roughness. It tells us how many cracks are in an area. And then it also goes through, and of all the treatments that we can do, it determines what year and with our budget when we should go out there and do that type of maintenance.
How do you determine the routes that you're going to drive on any given day when you go out?
Well, arterial and collector streets, majors and collectors as another term, we run 100% of that. Throughout the entire city. The residential subdivisions, currently we were only running a third, and we've got it already set up which streets we're going to run. By next year, we plan to be running 100% of residentials.
So we're driving up Central Avenue here. We're just crossing McKinley, coming up on Roosevelt. It looks like, I mean, I'm not an expert here, but it looks like the pavement's doing okay. There are no big cracks here, no dips, anything like that. Do you get the sense that when you get back to the office and look at what the software tells you, I mean, do you think it's going to tell you that this area is generally doing okay?
Yes, it is. And one thing that I do when we're out driving around is when I see a particularly really bad street, once I process that information, when I'm out in the field, I make a note of it. And once I get that data processed, I go and look to make sure that it does have a reasonable, you know, analysis. The slide is green. Now I'm going to start the process. That's it. So all the cameras are running at this time. And then once we get to the end of a section of the street, we can stop it.
So what are all the numbers that are moving right now, chainage and roughness?
That's just the distance that we're going right there. And then the roughness. I mentioned the two lasers in the front. That's the left laser and that's the right laser. We like to keep that under 200.
So one of them is that the right one is at 244. That indicates that there might be a problem.
We just hit a big bump. Yep. You felt it. And then, so it's a little delayed. So let's see if we hit something here. Here's this manhole. Now watch the right one. There's the manhole that we just hit.
What is the worst area that you've seen in the time that you've been doing this?
Oh, wow. Really very, very bumpy. Down where all the warehouses are, where all the big trucks come in, it's called shoving, where those big trucks are stopping at the stoplights and you just get, it's like a rutting in the asphalt. It is really bad for your car. If you don't have to stop at that light and you drive straight through, it's going to throw you around a little bit.
I would imagine in a van like this, you kind of get a sense of where there are problems and you're probably going to bounce around a little bit.
This van is very heavy and we feel everything.
That much I can confirm. After the ride with Nunn, during which we collected data, I headed to City Hall to talk to Ruben Lally about where that information goes and how it's used. He's the pavement programming manager for Phoenix's Street Transportation Department and a fan of the assessing van.
The main thing for the van for us is that, you know, it helps us really to look and visualize the condition of all our streets so that we can strategically implement programs to either keep the streets in good condition or repair old street, you know. And that's the strategy we are trying to go with now, because generally it's cheaper to keep a good street in good condition than to replace a new one.
Lally says engineers upload the images and data that come back from the van and use it to quantify the distresses on Phoenix's roadways. He says the software can even help figure out which projects fit into the department's budget in a given year.
The process involves, you know, algorithms that detects the cracks, the crack type, you know, and then, you know, it gives value to the right condition. And then we convert it into some indices that we combine to be able to give us, an, you know, ratings for the street.
And then you figure out what to do about it, right?
Yes, it helps us determine what to do about it and in which order to do them.
Do you find that certain parts of the city tend to have more problems, more cracks, more other problems than other parts of the city?
Yes, definitely. You know, the streets are infrastructure that once built, you know, just grows old. So the older part of the city would have, you know, generally have more deteriorated streets than the others. And but it turns around, because when that happens, it means we'll be shifting focus to where the pavements are old. And then those pavements will become new again. And then, you know, so it's a cycle that we go through.
When you're on the East Coast, especially this time of year, when it starts to get a little bit warmer after the winter, people complain about potholes or potholes all over the place. Does the weather here and the extreme climate do anything to pavement?
Yes, generally the heat will affect the pavement, you know, the surface condition. But you know what? I would take the harsh effects of the heat over that of the snow, because as you know, the snow makes the pavement really brittle, and then, you know, you have potholes everywhere. The reason why we have relatively good roads in Arizona is because we have the problem of the heat, which also affects the pavement, but in a different way.
Ruben Lally is the pavement programming manager for Phoenix's Street Transportation Department. We'll post some photos of the van at theshow.kjzz.org.
Imagine sliding the screen door open and walking into the backyard, ready to do some gardening or trimming or eating, and then it happens. You're hit by a wall of insects as midge flies relentlessly buzz around your head. That's how a group of Gilbert residents living near the town's South Water Recharge Facility have been feeling. So the town is taking action. I'm joined by Water Resources Manager Eric Brown. Eric, how long ago did the complaints about this begin?
Well, we've known that the South Recharge Facility has had water percolation issues for several years. The facility is designed for the water to infiltrate into the soil, and it has not been doing as good of a job of doing of infiltrating into the soil as quickly as we'd like. So we've had standing water out there in years past when we would hope that the water would percolate into the soil and then the basins would dry out. We never really had many issues up until about 2 years ago, when homes were built in close proximity to the facility. So last winter and spring, we started to get some complaints from the homeowners. And our suspicion at the time was that it was a really mild winter last year. And so there wasn't the really cold temperatures to keep the insects from breeding.
You've been doing some fogging. Can you tell us about that? How often can you fog? Is there any danger to the community? And is that why there's a limited amount of fogging you can do?
So we have been fogging year-round at the South Recharge site 3 days per week. with a chemical that is approved by the EPA, and the 3 days per week is their maximum allowable amount that we can do. Recently, we have, because of the complaints from the homeowners, we've extended our fogging into the neighborhood streets adjacent to the recharge site to try to help mitigate this kind of increased influx of the midge flies.
Water has been temporarily shut off at the South Recharge facility. Is that accurate?
Yes, we shut off the water last week as kind of an emergency action.
Does that cause any other problems, even if it's temporarily shut off?
Yes, it's caused some other infrastructure problems for us. We've had to reroute the remaining reclaimed water that has not been gone to direct use by other customers. In the process of rerouting that other water, we did encounter a couple of reclaimed water main breaks that we suspect were caused by our actions. And now we're directing most of the water to our main recharge site, the riparian preserve.
Is this something that wasn't planned well, wasn't designed well, or is this just a concept that it worked okay until people moved nearby?
We've looked at a lot of models, a lot of studies as far as where to site these recharge facilities, and the models indicated that this was a good site. The difficulty arises when you try to figure out what's below the ground. You can't see down there, and it's not an even distribution of rock and soils down there. One hydrologist described it as looking at a marble cake from the outside and trying to identify what's inside by sticking a straw in. And so when you do some investigation, some borings, you get a piece, a little tiny piece of the picture, but not the full picture. And what we have discovered through actual operation of the site is that the soils underneath the ground are not as conducive to recharge as we had initially believed. So we have to go and fix it.
Eric Brown is the Town of Gilbert's Water Resources Manager. We've been talking about midge flies and the efforts to get rid of them from one area of Gilbert. Eric, thank you.
We appreciate it. Thanks a lot, Steve.
The town says the long-term solution will begin in late spring or early summer with a construction project aimed at fixing the percolation issues.
The use of the chemical PCB was prohibited back in the 1980s, but it persists in the environment. Scientists are warning the banned pollutant is now accumulating in top ocean predators at worryingly high levels. The BBC's Rebecca Morrell reports.
So I'll just open the bag.
At the Zoological Society of London, in a stark white room, a forensic investigation is about to get underway.
Give it a hose down and clean it up.
A harbour porpoise found washed up in the southwest of England is lying on a metal table, ready for its post-mortem.
It's a female, adult. It could even be pregnant.
Whenever a marine mammal is found dead along the UK coastline, its death is probed. But wildlife vet Dr. Paul Jepson says he's worried.
What we've been finding in stranded marine mammals is quite high levels of a particular type of chemical pollutant. Some of the species, the levels are probably among the highest in the world right now, and we're really very, very concerned about them.
The start of the 20th century was a golden age for chemistry.
Chemists are the most versatile of men. They make their presence and knowledge felt in almost every sphere of human activity.
And PCBs, or polychlorinated biphenyls, were heralded as wonder chemicals. They were used in everything from plastics to paints, lubricants and electrical appliances. But it was later realised that they're toxic, hence a sequence of bans across the world throughout much of the 1980s. But despite this, PCBs have persisted in the environment.
So this is the blubber sample we take, which would be what we would test for the chemical pollutants.
Tests like this one have been carried out on more than 1,000 marine mammals around Europe. Every single one was contaminated with PCBs. Dr. Paul Jepson says this is leading to significant problems.
If we have very high concentrations, then there's a range of toxic effects, but probably the one we're most worried about is the suppression of reproduction, that basically the dolphins just stop reproducing normally, and we think this is having a devastating effect on their conservation.
It's estimated that in Europe there are 1.1 million tonnes of PCB-containing appliances awaiting disposal. I asked Professor Ian Boyd, Chief Scientific Advisor for the UK Government's Environment Department, if we're doing enough.
We are dealing with a big legacy here. PCBs were manufactured in very large amounts between about the 1930s and 1980s.
He says the UK and other countries in Europe are working to get rid of the remaining chemicals.
I think we need to make sure that the marine mammal problem is kept in proportion. Yes, there is a PCB problem there. We've had PCB problems in other marine mammals in the past, for example, in seals in the Baltic. Seal populations are now recovering. The PCB problem hasn't completely gone away, but it's been largely dealt with. We can deal with this. But it takes quite a lot of time to take these PCBs out of the system.
So we're opening into the body cavity, so into the abdominal tract.
Back in the autopsy, and Dr. Jepson makes a discovery.
So what we've actually found is that the animal has been pregnant because the cervix has dilated, so she's obviously actually recently aborted. There's no fetus in here, but it does look like there might be an infection because of this very abnormal looking fluid. So it's like a septic infection of the uterus, perhaps.
This infection is the cause of death, both for the mother and its lost calf. Samples will now be sent off for tests, but the team here believes PCBs may well be implicated.
In any single individual animal, it's impossible to say that's PCB that caused that, but overall, I think that actually the PCB is probably, in at least some of these cases, is actually suppressing immunity and predisposing to these infections that ultimately can cause death.
That's Dr. Paul Jepson speaking to the BBC's Rebecca Morrell. Venture Madness. It's just like March Madness, except replace college basketball teams with the most promising startup companies in the state. For the last 4 weeks, 64 young companies have been narrowed down to the top 16. And starting tomorrow at Talking Stick Resort in Scottsdale, they'll face off in a bracket-style competition until only one is left standing. KJZZ's Lauren Gilger goes inside the offices of last year's big winner to find out what it's all about.
This is our development team here.
Greg Scoresby is showing me around the Gilbert offices of his startup tech education company, Campus Logic.
Sales and marketing here.
They're a financial aid software company that makes that traditionally confusing and paper-heavy process personalized and mobile.
Because we're a young startup, we have the obligatory game room with ping pong table, putting hole in the floor, dartboard.
A year ago, Campus Logic had about 15 employees, a few customers, and a little bit of revenue.
We're now at 40 employees 1 year later. We closed a $7.5 million round of financing, and Venture Madness was a very key part, a very key catalyst for us in both attracting talent and attracting capital.
Campus Logic won last year's Venture Madness competition. They took home $30,000 in prize money, which was helpful, Scoresby said. But even more so, they got invaluable exposure and advice.
So we had people come up right after we won Venture Madness and say, I want to invest and I want to be part of Campus Logic.
The competition starts with a bracket of 64 startup companies. They go through two rounds of online eliminations, and the top 16 advance to the live rounds. There, the teams face off, pitching their idea to a panel of judges and trying to convince them that that idea is destined to take off. Invest Southwest and the Arizona Commerce Authority launched Venture Madness 2 years ago because of the explosion of startups in the Valley, according to longtime software executive and Venture Madness judge Greg Head.
I've been in Arizona 20 years. Years and I've never seen this level of activity, and it's very exciting.
He says events like this, and there are a lot of them in the Valley now, are not only good for startups looking for funding, they're good for Arizona's economy.
Some of our biggest employers here in the Valley were started here in the Valley as little startups and small businesses that grew up. It's not just about attracting big companies to the Valley, it's about growing our own. And that's harder than it looks, but that's where the big part of growth comes from.
This is a super accessible startup community, unlike other communities. If you want to talk to any CEO in town, you can pretty much talk to any CEO.
Scoresby says Phoenix is the most generous startup community out there, and that spirit of generosity is what drives Venture Madness. During the competition, each team is assigned a mentor who helps them refine their pitch for each stage of the competition.
In the first meeting, my team of mentors said, I don't really get it. I don't get what you're talking about. I don't get the problem. So one thing they really did was help me simplify the message.
In your pitch, you can't talk about technology and coding and development that will drive your startup forward. Instead, Scoresby says at the end of the day, startups are all about solving problems.
If you have a problem that's worth solving and people are willing to pay you to solve that problem, your company's going to be successful.
And the problem he proposed solving in front of last year's judges was a big one.
We've got $1.3 trillion worth of student debt in this country. We have fewer young people starting businesses, forming households, buying houses because of this student debt burden hanging around their neck. So we need people to borrow more responsibly, but we also need to drive accessibility for those that need aid the most.
Was that your pitch right there?
Partly, yes.
In Gilbert, Lauren Gilger, KJZZ News.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.